Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. Today, we're talking about reflections on the evangelical fracturing. Hey, listeners, how's it going? We're going to take up an article that Jake Meter wrote in January 2024 at Mere Orthodoxy, where he is sort of looking back on what he calls the evangelical fracturing that he believes we are 10 years in to. And I think that's interesting. So I wanted to reflect on it. Obviously, one of the things we want to do on this podcast is help Christians be wise students and stewards of culture. And so a lot of the things we try to talk about relate to the church's interactions with the culture and to sort of the broader dynamics of church in America. And certainly over the last 10 years, this has been one of the dominant storylines. You recall us doing some episodes a few years ago on the six-way fracturing of the evangelical church. That was an article that Mike Graham wrote for Mere Orthodoxy back in 2021. You've paid attention over the past few years to sort of how the Trump phenomenon has fractured evangelicalism. And so there's a lot that has been talked about over the past few years, but certainly we would all say over the past 10 years, something has changed in the dynamic of what we would refer to as American evangelical Christianity, assuming that those words still mean something. So I wanted to tackle and talk a little bit about this article for two reasons. One, I'm interested in how Jake understands it and what he sort of sees and some of the connections he's making. And number two, because his approach is to talk about the Acts 29 network as sort of a case study in the evangelical fracturing. And so since I have been a part of Acts 29 for many years, and since Chris, you have as well, since our churches have invested heavily in that network, I thought it was interesting sort of, I probably agree with some things Jake says here. I probably have some disagreements with how he frames things, but I thought it was interesting to see the Acts 29 church planting network as sort of a way in to understanding the fracturing of the evangelical movement, if there is such a thing. And that's what this article is designed to sort of tease out. So I'm not going to really read much of the article, but I do want to tell you why Jake thinks we are 10 years in to the evangelical fracturing. Jake Meter says at the end of this article, if we place the beginning of the fracturing in 2014 with the last Desiring God conference and the collapse of Mars Hill, then this year marks 10 years since that sad beginning. I think it's an interesting way of marking it. He basically says that was the last Desiring God conference, and it was the collapse of Mars Hill. Those things happened in 2014. And of course, also 2014 was Ferguson, and then 2016 was the Trump election. And so certainly that season of time was when some things really shifted in evangelicalism. Do you like his taxonomy there, Chris?
When was the last Together for the Gospel conference?
Well, that was just like this past year. I think they just stopped doing that.
So they went a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I have a better...
As good a marker as any?
Yeah, a better marker.
I understand the framework. Yes. I mean, I understand why he would pick those events.
Yeah, it certainly seems, if we look back, it seems that things started to shift post-2014.
Meter says that he's sort of thought of these ideas while reading Mike Cosper's forthcoming book. I guess Cosper has a memoir coming out that's called sort of like A Faith Lost and Found or something like that. And I haven't read it. I don't know if it's going to be a good book. Sometimes I really like what Mike does, and sometimes I'm real skeptical of what Mike does. But apparently, the way Jake narrates it, part of how Cosper tells the story is to narrate what was happening in the Acts 29 network at that time. Mike Cosper was part of Sojourn Church in Louisville, which was an Acts 29 church. And he and I together were a part of sort of the early years of Acts 29. And so here's what Jake, let me read you a few excerpts of sort of what he describes about that season of time. There was a blending of innocence and confidence and hopefulness that Cosper captures well. I wasn't part of it directly, but I remember it. From about 2005 until the early 2010s, it seemed as if Acts 29 might represent the defining movement in the next wave of evangelicalism. They had found a way of blending the best insights of the attractional movement of Bill Hybels and Rick Warren
with the theological and missiological acumen of Tim Keller and John Piper. I do think that's a pretty simple way of summarizing what mm-hmm. Acts 29 was trying to do. It was theologically informed by sort of Reformed orthodoxy, but was very missional in the sense of wanting to see churches grow and wanting to reach mm-hmm. non-Christians.
Yeah, that was the thing that initially attracted me to Acts 29 was the strong theology and the strong mission and some of the aesthetic too, and just kind of where I was in my spiritual journey. But to see a group that was like, hey, these two things have for so long have felt like they're against each other now, but no, they don't have to be. So yeah.
He calls it a particular grunge inflected aesthetic.
Well, you get the Seattle influence.
Yeah, do you
too.
Agree with that? That's a good way of describing it. It was like flannels and jeans and
beards and boots and coffee and
Timbuktu bags.
Yeah.
There was, we used to joke when I would go to an Acts 29 event, we would like sit at a coffee shop and just try to pick out like who are the guys coming in that are Acts 29 guys, because there was a certain sort of like vibe. Right.
Still to this day, you can just tell when guys, there's been multiple times where I've been in an event, walked into a place, some other people walked in and like, you're here for the conference, right? Yes. Yeah.
Meter goes on to say, or to talk about three defining leaders of Acts 29 in that era. That's Mark Driscoll, Darren Patrick, Matt Chandler. He says Mark Driscoll represented the kind of alpha figure who could draw a crowd, win a following, and define the direction of the network through sheer charisma and force of will. Darren Patrick, meanwhile, represented a more cerebral and patient voice who was in many ways ahead of his time in his analysis of cultural issues. Matt Chandler was the more personable balance to Driscoll. Driscoll would deliver the bodies behind the bus type speeches, and Chandler could then come in behind to help patch up whatever relational issues were created by Driscoll's harsh style. And Meter goes on to point out that back in the Reformation, this was very common. You had Melanchthon and Luther, you had Bucer and Calvin. You sort of had these different personalities that sort of moderated one another and, you know, complemented one another. I think it is interesting the way he describes those three guys. I agree and disagree. Darren, I'm not sure I would describe Darren Patrick as a cerebral and patient voice.
I would
Darren pretty well, and I don't know that many people would call him cerebral and patient. I guess that's how Jake experienced his influence. Mm-hmm. Driscoll, as an alpha figure who could draw a crowd through sheer charisma, that is a great description of Mark Driscoll.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a power of charisma that is almost creepy to me. It's amazing the energy that guy can bring into a room. I have lots of thoughts looking back on Mark.
Yeah, but and that's what's interesting. I have always found Chandler a more compelling communicator, but Driscoll has that thing that, because I mean I've listened to I don't know how many Driscoll talk sermons and. Always thought the content was solid and good, but I never go, that guy's just like this super compelling dude on stage. But he still had this thing that, like, I think enhanced his ability to speak, where Chandler's just like this very charismatic communicator.
Yes.
And so those kind of those little differences.
I think the way he describes Chandler as the more sort of personable guy, that's certainly true of just how Matt's wired. Mm-hmm. What all three of those guys, though, if you think about what brought them together, and what do they share in common? It was they were all fascinating preachers, and they could all preach to younger, more skeptical, more post-Christian audiences. So what Keller did was sort of a more professorial bent. Mark Driscoll and Darren Patrick and Matt Chandler were doing was sort of a younger, more assertive, aggressive, sort of like deconstructionist bent. All those guys, I really enjoyed all those guys preaching, and it was very influential in our movement early on.
Yeah. And they did it in different contexts.
Yes.
Which is also pretty telling, where, you know, Driscoll's up in Seattle, very much more agnostic, atheist, secular. Chandler's down in, you know, the buckle of the Bible Belt, you know, and then Darren Patrick was in kind of a blend in some ways. So just their ability to contextualize all that was really cool to see too.
Meter points out, in a happier timeline, Driscoll, Patrick, and Chandler would still have another 15 to 20 years of effective ministry ahead of them. Driscoll is only 53, Patrick would be 53, and Chandler is 49. Of course, that isn't the timeline we've gotten. Driscoll's story took a dark turn. toward ever greater autonomy and away from real accountability. Mars Hill collapsed, and the magic of those early years never returned. Darren Patrick tragically took his own life. Chandler has remained in ministry at the Village. So he said, like, you know, these guys could have had a really long run. Circumstances changed that. And so Meter sort of wants to look back and say, what is it that fractured that brotherhood or that sort of energy of the early Acts 29 movement? And how is that a sort of story that plays out, that sort of points to what's going on in broader evangelicalism? And he points to a few things. Number one is technology. He says, you know, one thing Acts 29 did well in that 2005 to 2014 window is it capitalized on especially podcasting. And that was true. I felt like that was part of the magic of the movement was, Meter points out, it was the beginnings of podcasting, but you didn't yet have social media. And so you had the ability to like get your content out there without all the like having to get caught up and embroiled in weird online controversies. And I remember for us, when we planted Quorum Deo in 2005, you know, Tyler Zock was one of the guys on our core team. He was like, hey, we need a podcast. And I was like, what's that? He was like, Well, it's, you know, it's like a way of like putting your sermons out there. I was like, you mean like CDs? He's like, no, it like goes on an iPod and, you know, you can listen to it. And
you
like,
can't see it.
I was like, cool. That sounds great. How does it, you know, I was like, I've never heard of this before. And so, you know, that sounds funny to say that today because it's so much a part of our lives. But back then, we were the first church in the city of Omaha to have a podcast. No one else was doing that because it was an early adopter, small minority of people who tended to be very techie who were into that. But, you know, we capitalized on that. And for the first few years, we really gained a lot of momentum because we had a podcast. And so I think he's right about that.
Yeah, it's funny. I would download Matt Chandler sermons and burn them on CDs.
Yeah.
And listen to them in my car. I did not actually listen to the podcast directly.
I had the old iPad where you had to scroll, the scroll wheel.
Yeah.
You had to scroll.
I found that in my basement the other day. I really did. I showed my kids.
For our 1 year, that was actually for our 1 year birthday as a church in 2006, we gifted Jared Strock an iPod because it was like, this is like the coolest gift we can give you. It was like it's expensive and it's new and it's like, man, it's music, you know?
Click, that was, click, 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 click.
That was a while back. The second thing that Meter points to is leadership failure. And, you know, he points out that obviously as Mars Hill collapsed and Driscoll fled ecclesial oversight and discipline, the leadership that had framed, guided, and directed the network began to fail. And that's certainly true. You know, Driscoll's personal unwillingness to submit to his elders and what they were asking him to do, you know, that was the beginning of the end, or the beginning of the end of this season of Acts 29. It was pretty clear that, you know, Acts 29 is going to have to go a different direction. The funny backstory here that our listeners probably don't know is that there was a tense meeting between Matt Chandler, Darren Patrick, and Driscoll in about 2012, where those guys basically said to Mark, hey, you need to give us the reins. Like they were not, Driscoll at that time was sort of trying to take over leadership of Acts 29 again. He had given it away and he was sort of trying to grab the wheel. And those two guys were like, that's not the path forward. And I've heard stories of that meeting told in some various rooms. And it sounds like it was a pretty intense confrontation between those three dudes. But I think that's why you ended up in 2012 having leadership pass to Matt Chandler and Matt moving the Acts 29 offices to Dallas and sort of taking it under the wing of the Village instead of Mars Hill as a way to sort of separate it from, hey, Mark, you do you, but Acts 29 needs to move into a chapter where it's not driven by the force of your personality. And I think that was a good call. And in hindsight, right, a really important call based on what was happening with Driscoll just a few short years later. The third thing that Meter points out is leadership styles. He says people end up being either thought leaders or people leaders. And Acts 29 had both. It's an interesting, I think he's borrowing this from someone else. He says that he had a conversation with someone and they teed up these categories for him. But he says, you know, some people are more thought leaders who are more focused on ideas. Some people are more people leaders who are lead, you know, who want to shepherd the flock and lead human beings. And Acts 29 had a pretty good matrix of both of those kinds of leaders. And that was part of the beauty of the recipe was there were both of those kinds of people in the room, and there was a real good symbiosis of the sort of energy that's created from both kinds of leaders hashing things out together.
In light of that, it is interesting because when the network went more to Chandler's leadership, I think it went from thought leader, charisma leader, to people leader, pastor. Mm-hmm. And I think we all had, you know, some concerns at that point, but also some excitement.
Yes, agreed. So Meter is basically saying, you know, the one of the questions that was being answered at that moment was, what is the future of evangelicalism? So kind of the way Jake Meter's narrating the story is, you know, if you had, roughly speaking, you know, John Piper, Tim Keller, and Don Carson, and that generation of leader who had sort of formed a pretty dense network of like early 21st century evangelical leadership. You know, those guys were doing the conferences and they were sort of pulling together various people and, you know, trying to create some synergy. It felt like maybe the next phase of that, the next generation of that, is going to be Mark Driscoll, Darren Patrick, Matt Chandler, that sort of Acts 29-ish energy. And when Acts 29 sort of fell apart in 2014, or when Mars Hill fell apart in 2014, and when Darren later on took his own life, that it became clear that that handoff is not what it's going to look like. And so what it left, the question it left open is, what is the next generation of evangelicalism beyond Carson and Keller and, you know, that generation of leaders? And basically what Meter is saying is the inability to sort of answer that question is kind of what led to the fracturing of evangelicalism. So now you have a bunch of different sort of like sub tribes, but you don't have that sense of like, oh, there's a clear leader in our generation or set of leaders in our generation who are sort of like stepping in and filling the void and moving forward in the same sort of collaborative and gospel oriented way that Carson and Keller and Piper and some of those guys were.
What's also interesting about what Jake is saying is that the various threads that Acts 29 kind of held together seem to have kind of gone their own separate ways in some distinct
Talk
aspects.
Talk more about that.
Where if you kind of think of a Reformed orthodoxy, a missional emphasis, the way he talks about kind of the propositional cognitive religion where it's, you know, teaching truth, teaching doctrine, and then the more expressivist sort of experiential religion, which again, Acts 29 did a good job of, where once that fractured, it seemed like you have this strong bent to one or the other, and they've kind of gone back to being in opposition or maybe seeing as in a very strong tension such that they're kind of just almost like magnets opposing each other. So that's another interesting piece of this, of what we have on the other side of guys kind of holding things together is just things that we were all celebrating were brought together, now seem to be like, no, it actually makes sense that they should be in different kind of different camps or different emphasis, which I don't love. Like, I'm still like, let's hold these things together. Let's keep fighting for these things to be together. But it doesn't seem like that's what evangelicalism wants right now.
Yeah. And I think Meter's making an argument in this piece that I don't necessarily buy. But his argument is that, you know, if you think about that older generation of leaders, think of guys like John Piper, Tim Keller, Don Carson. Meter says the fact that those older men spent relatively little time being shaped within a technique-obsessed sociological block is perhaps enormously important for understanding their success and relative health. The connection he's drawing there is like that podcasting is a technique. And, you know, that Mark and Darren and Matt and the rest of us who sort of ran in that stream were too shaped by the techniques of getting our stuff out there in a way that maybe prevented some of the deeper sort of like long-term wisdom that needed to grow. I don't know that I buy that. I think it's an interesting point. It just feels a little bit nostalgic to me. It feels like I'm not sure. I wonder if that is quite as clean a category as Jake wants to make it. It just feels to me like, well, I mean, I'm not sure that like podcasting as a technique just, you know, accounts for how come that coalition of guys kind of fell apart and, you know, that certain things happened in their lives that we would look back on and not commend.
I mean, isn't his and his point that they became popular, they became seen as authorities in some ways, but they didn't have the maturity to sort of handle that?
Yes, I guess that's his point.
Yeah, but I think that's more his point. I think he's saying because of technology and because of the influence and the voice and the momentum, even with social media coming onto the scene, they had too much influence too fast.
Yes,
for their own maturity.
Well, and I think he may, sitting where I'm sitting right now and looking at Mark Driscoll's story, I'm saying, okay, there's certainly something he's saying that's true there. But I'm also aware that John Calvin wrote the Institutes when he was 26 years old. You know, so I'm just saying, like, I don't think that church history is the only guys who ever have deep influence in a long ministry have influence in their 50s. I'm like, I'm not sure you can sort of make that clean of a distinction. Mm. I've reckoned with my own sort of like, how does this fit into my story here? Because I certainly can't make sense of Mark Driscoll's trajectory. Like, it's just mystifying to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as I look back on these years of Acts 29, when it felt like, man, there was some grace from God upon that movement and it was growing and there was churches being planted and there was a really healthy influence of reformed soteriology and good ecclesiology and a focus on the local church. I loved all that stuff. And I still feel like, man, God was up to something back then. Mm-hmm. And then I also, the more I experience the trajectory of Mark Driscoll, the more I think maybe that guy was playing us the whole time. Like I don't know if he has a convictional bone in his body other than just what seems to work at the current moment. And so there's a part of me that's just perplexed by what was going on in the mid 2000s. And was it a Mark Driscoll who was a charismatic leader leading out of conviction, or was it just a charlatan doing whatever it took to get views and clicks?
So is it possible that Driscoll is a pragmatist at heart, but he covers it very well?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, I remember in seminary, in I think it was like pastoral leadership class, we read Driscoll's book on the founding of Mars Hill and what was that?
Confessions of Reformation.
Yeah. And I remember my professor going, this is church growth for cool kids. Mm. And so he was basically saying, hey, there's not a lot of difference between Driscoll and like the Hybels and the Rick Warrens. Like mm-hmm. there's a lot of cover, you know, of like deeper theology and these things. But at the end of the day, it's just pragmatism. It's a cooler form of pragmatism.
Well, and I think that is true, yet also feels simplistic to me.
Because
Cosper makes that same connection in the podcast, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure maybe in his memoir as well, he connects, you know, Driscoll and the sort of like to Robert Schuller and to Bill Hybels and the whole church growth connection. But also going back to that early paragraph in this Meter article, he talks about there was a blending of innocence and confidence and hopefulness that Cosper captures well. That there was something, despite what I think Mark Driscoll's personal, I wasn't even going to use the word weaknesses. I would almost call them like narcissistic compulsions are, you know, the whatever he was up to in his own world, what was happening in Acts 29 at that moment was bigger than Mark and was in a sense, a bunch of guys like you, Chris, and like me and like you, Dusty, who were like, there was a really dense network of people who loved the church, loved theology, loved the gospel and loved the mission of God. And something was happening there.
Yeah.
Now
that's good.
So the three guys that were sort of like figureheads of that aren't the sum and substance to me of like, what was that? And that's where I feel like the weakness of this piece is saying, here's what was happening with these three very visible leaders. That doesn't to me tell the whole story of how do we make sense of everything God was doing at the grassroots level in the church at that moment in time. But I am compelled by Meter's assertion that had Mark Driscoll and Darren Patrick and Matt all sort of stayed on the trajectory they were on, I wonder if we would be at a different moment in evangelicalism, and if part of the fracturing we've experienced was sort of a result of that something was there was a harbinger of something when that couldn't hold together.
Yeah.
When the sort of relationships and sort of the density of that couldn't stay together.
Yeah. This is a little bit outside of Meter's article, but I am also wondering if there's something to the argument that I've heard this argument made multiple times, multiple ways, that one of the big issues you see in evangelicalism is the inability of the boomer generation to kind of pass the baton.
Yes.
And even if you look at guys like Keller and Carson and Piper, like I think they've tried in their local context. But if you think about the bigger sort of network of evangelicalism, I don't know if we've seen that kind of thing happen. And I don't even know what that necessarily looks like. But it seemed, you know, Driscoll, Darren Patrick, Chandler, like they were sort of handed the mantle because they became popular. And so I also wonder if it is somehow these, you know, I don't know how this would happen, but if there was a shepherding of that leadership responsibility in some ways. And I know, you know, Piper tried to work with Driscoll, and I know there were attempts at that kind of thing. In some ways, this is, you know, to Driscoll, the kind of the downside of Driscoll's personality is this big, he had this big thing. So he had a lot of power, a lot of influence. And so he could tell guys like, hey, I don't really need you, so I don't need to listen to you. But just even that sense of how do you take guys like, you know, the guys like Carson and Piper and Keller, who had this deep level of maturity, here you have these young dudes that come along that really became popular very quickly and you know, through podcasting, and how that could have that been shepherded in some ways. I wonder about that, but I without really knowing what that would have looked like.
What's interesting about that, to apply Meter's own language here, is those are all very much thought leaders.
Yeah.
So I think you're going to need a different mixture along the way.
It's interesting that one thing I am very grateful for about the Acts 29 movement, whether we're talking about strengths or weaknesses, is that there was a deep love for the local church.
Yeah.
And because it was a church planting movement, the energy was always, let's plant churches. So what's interesting about the podcasting as a platform is, for podcasting to be a platform, you have to be preaching to, like, you know, no one, I guess people probably do now, but back then no one had a podcast that was them preaching to their basement. You know, it was like they're preaching to a group of people.
Yeah.
And so it generated this sense of, I think the reason it felt like it's a handoff is because it felt like, man, Keller is a churchman and Carson is a churchman and John Piper is a churchman. And these guys are churchmen. They're building churches that in places like Seattle that are very secular. And so there was an emphasis on the local church. What seems to have happened now is you have people who are literally social media influencers.
Yeah.
And that's kind of their platform. It doesn't matter whether they're leading a church or not leading a church. It doesn't matter how healthy or not healthy their church is. A lot of the energy in sort of modern evangelicalism is just driven by, do you have a lot of Twitter followers or do you have a good YouTube channel? Or, you know, it's divorced from the context of leading a congregation. And I wonder if that's part of the fracturing of evangelicalism, is the question of, is this a church-centric movement?
Yeah.
Or is this an influence-centric movement?
That's a good point. Because even the guys that were attracted to Acts 29 that kind of had that hunger for, I want a platform, they had to still plant a church, shepherd that church, have a podcast. You still had to create a local church. Even if your heart was like for bigger and better things, you still had to ground yourself and prove that you could ground yourself before you were given anything. Where now it's like, if you get enough people to watch your videos, you could be just sitting in your basement and not a single soul in the world will follow you actually in your real life. And yet here you are being an influencer.
I assessed a guy one time in 2009 in Seattle at a conference. And his sermon was, he had just sat down in his living room and preached it to his computer. And his assessment did not go well. No. We were like, hey, unless you've preached a sermon to actual humans, you're not ready to plant a church yet. Like, we got some work to do back here.
Yeah. But it does speak, you know, going back to your point, it does speak to the beauty again of what Acts 29 was doing, is it was attracting guys who wanted to plant churches. And the majority of those guys really were churchmen, and they wanted to, they loved the local church and they believed in the local church, and they were reading New Beginning, they're reading Keller of, hey, the mission of God goes forward by churches planting churches. Like, all of that was the innocence, the purity, the hopefulness of kind of recapturing that missionary movement through the local church, which was so beautiful. But somehow the bigger layer got out of control and something, and you know, technology and various things, but the leadership breakdowns or whatever. But that's what I think maybe the sad part of this is, not that there aren't still people who want to, you know, plant churches and you know, see the local church as the missionary engine, but the higher level cultural stuff has kind of clouded that a little bit, I would say today, in some ways. So that hopefulness, maybe the innocence isn't there in the same way.
It's interesting if we ask, okay, what should a listener do with this podcast? I mean, we're sort of doing a postmortem on a on a movement, you know.
We're all working it out here.
We're working out the last 20 years of our lives. But what should a listener do with this? And I think what you just said is the answer, Chris. I think the future for the church is the local church.
Yeah.
Amen. Strong ecclesiology.
And the future of whatever evangelicalism is, who cares? The future, the thing I want to give my life to is helping local churches thrive, helping them be healthy. I could care less what quote unquote if evangelicalism as we know it survives or falls apart is no concern of mine. I'm not trying to keep a movement afloat or keep a podcast afloat or some kind of influence afloat. I want to see the church thrive. And so I think there's a weird reality that in most of my ministry life, you know, Christians in general are usually, hopefully, part of a local church. But also there's this whole evangelical ecosystem of conferences and books and podcasts and bloggers and influencers. And so people are kind of immersed in that whole thing. And here's what I generally find. The more their local church is the center of that stuff, the healthier people they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And the more the local church takes a back seat to sort of that broader ecosystem, the less healthy I feel like those human beings are, and the less I think it grounds them in the things that really matter to Jesus.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I would say to this day, this is only my take, but if you ask me what shifted, this is like one of those dangerous things, like who knows, but in Mark Driscoll's preaching, I believe, in 2009 or 10, there was a shift, and here's how I describe it. When I started listening to Driscoll sermons, which was 2006, he was preaching to the city of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about him is he knows what his people are reading. He knows the parks they go to. He knows that there's more dogs than kids in Seattle. He just makes all these jokes that are clear that like he has a deep understanding of his context. About 2009 or 10, he started preaching to the podcast.
Yeah.
And his preaching was less grounded in the smells and sounds of the city of Seattle. And it was just more like I'm preaching to general humanity. And when I felt that shift, it saddened me because I was like, man, what I gathered from that guy's preaching was how to talk to a city.
Yeah.
And now it's like, he's kind of talking to the world, you know, Mars Hill, Dubai or whatever. they're trying to colonize the universe, you know, and F campuses everywhere. Yeah. And in other words, to sort of put a bow on all that, I think the beauty of gospel ministry and mission is anchoring it in a place.
Yeah.
And I want listeners of our podcast and people who care about the churches flourishing to be anchored in a place and anchored in a local church. And then, you know, sure, there are some things that culturally are similar across the Western world. And so we can talk about, you know, the influence of technology, the influence of gender ideology, all these things matter. And that's why we have this podcast, is because we want to help people think about them. But the groundedness of caring about a real people in a real place,
yeah,
was to me the magic of what Acts 29 had that it lost,
yeah,
in that shift. And what I want to sort of recapture, or what I hope to recapture with our lives,
yeah,
with my life,
a sense of locality, you know,
and maybe that will be one of the beautiful things that kind of comes on the other side of this. Is we saw the beauty of that. It kind of got out of hand with, you know, podcasting technology kind of took, and you know, some legit leadership breakdowns. But to go back to that, hey, what made that so compelling was the contextual church planting, the local church, the mission of God going forward through the local church, being a local church pastor, pastoring your people. And yeah, if God uses you beyond that, beautiful. But to see the beauty of that local church ministry kind of come back to, you know, the excitement for that to come again. And we know this, Bob, like it's harder to plant a church now than it was 20 years ago.
Yep.
And there are multiple reasons for that, but that doesn't mean that we want to say, hey, let's take a time out on church planting altogether. Now we need to reevaluate and think through some things, but we want that still to be what we're about. And so maybe that's where we can say, I'm hopeful that on the this fracturing of evangelicalism, we'll kind of just get back to that and kind of get over the all the celebrity stuff and the technology stuff.
Yes. Amen.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.